resist the urge to shift. You may be seated if you want to, but if that makes you shift, stand. You can take out your notes if you want to, but if that makes you shift, leave them in the seat next to you. Isn't it funny how we do that? You know, Think Differently is not just our brand. We're deeply invested in helping people find the way of thinking that leads to real and lasting freedom and wholeness. And it is always a way of thinking. It's not what we know, it's the way that we know it. Hence the dilemma that I described last night. We all kind of raised our hand to acknowledge we've been pursuing this thing. And many of you raised your hand to say, sometimes it gets better, but sometimes it gets worse the more we try. Others raised their hand to acknowledge, my friend's word, freedom in Christ, is just a myth. We raised our hands to say, it kind of seems like it sometimes. But it seems like it when we remain in a single way of thinking. And that way of thinking really is something we've been trained in our whole lives. In fact, that way of thinking is something we were born into. And like the young man born in prison I described last night, if you're born into prison, you only recognize the walls and what you're trying to get away from. You have no idea what's possible. We have no idea what's possible. I promised you last night I would talk about how we end up in this place. And so I want to talk to you today about Genesis 3, that moment in history when we all recognize that Adam and Eve did a thing. How dare they do this thing? And yet, I think it's the most misunderstood moment in all of Scripture. And as a result of misunderstanding Genesis 3, we apply a Genesis 4 mind to all of our thinking and all of our understanding. We even read Genesis 1 and 2 with a Genesis 4 mind. The Genesis 4 mind is the prisoner mind that I described last night. We didn't just walk out of the garden with a curse hanging over us, but a change in our nature. A change in our way of seeing, a change in our way of knowing, and therefore a change in our way of perceiving, engaging, and even understanding reality itself. So we read Genesis 1 and 2, where the target, the goal, the beauty of what's ours already because Jesus gave it back to us. We read Genesis 1 and 2 with a Genesis 4 mind, and we end up with the craziest definitions and the craziest understanding of exactly what happened in that moment standing between the two trees. You've got Adam and Eve, and they're presented with this moment where they're standing between two trees, and God tells them, don't eat this one. This is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil over here. He says, don't eat this one. And of course, you know what happens when you tell someone not to do something. I mean, not you guys, of course, but the average person on the street, you tell them not to cross the street when the light's red. Everything, it's that freedom thing, right? Something about us calls that freedom. If I don't do what you say, I'm free. There's something about us that immediately goes, oh, don't eat from this tree. You know, something about us wants that so badly. So here's the dilemma for us. There's a problem that took place in Genesis chapter 3. There's a major problem. It's the biggest problem the human soul faces. And the problem with problems is if we define problems wrongly, all of our solutions come out of how we defined our problems. Right? I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, have been since 1993. I was going to say since 93, the 1900s. It feels so long ago. Black and white television, dinosaurs walking the streets, you know, you remember the times. But one of the major tenets of the counseling world is that people don't come to counseling because they've got a problem. That may seem odd to you. Because that seems natural, right? People come to counseling because they've got a solution that's not working at all. And so the alcoholic doesn't have a problem with alcohol. He's got a problem with pain. And alcohol is a really bad solution to pain. There are legitimate, meaningful solutions to human pain, but alcohol is not one of them. And when we use a bad solution, it's because we've defined the problem in such a way the solution makes sense to ourselves, makes sense to our nervous system. We can even logically think, doesn't make sense to try to drink my problems away because my problem is drinking. No, your problem's not drinking, your problem's pain. Drinking, however, numbs you to it, and instead of being able to overcome it, you multiply it. Now, that's just one of thousands of examples of the human condition. We can laugh at the person I just talked about, but all of us are doing it right now while we sit here. Some people show up in church as a bad solution to their problem. Sorry, Joel. Not sorry. I get a ton of freedom here to say that kind of stuff, right? Some people get jobs at church as a bad solution to their problem. Some people take a job as a counselor, right? Sometimes we think a title, a position, a place, something's gonna be the solution to our problem. And when we get there, we go, why don't I feel different? But now we're in a position of authority and we have the same problem we had when we ached for that position. In the same way, that person who took the drink ached for that drink, but when they get a few of them down, they're like, this didn't really work. I feel kind of numb, but I don't feel better. And especially tomorrow morning. So what happens is people show up in counseling, and listen carefully, people come running to the promise of the gospel, not because they have a problem, but because they have a poorly defined solution to a poorly defined problem. And so what happens, we try to take away their solution and you just leave them kind of hanging in the wind. If we don't go back and give them what they really need, we just take away their counterfeit, their poorly defined solution. We take that away from them. They're still hungry. Polly and I are doing a cleanse right now. And I don't know if you've ever done that kind of thing where you like don't eat all the stuff you crave. I can fill my stomach up and my body is still hungry. Like it wants sugar. It especially wants bread, right? So you can give me some meat, but I'm still hungry. And you can give someone the wrong solution, and for a moment they feel some satisfaction, but they're still hungry. And I'm as convinced as can be that I've watched for decades now, since the 1990s, as I mentioned, I've watched for decades now that people show up in certain places and we give them a poorly defined solution to a poorly defined problem. Because Genesis 3 is the moment in all of history when the problem occurred that turned the course of human history towards this thing that Jesus showed up thousands of years later to fix. Without Genesis 3, we might not have Matthew 1 and 2, right? Jesus came to fix something that went wrong. And we all think we know what it is. We've been taught. We've been versed in it. Some of us think that even unconsciously, we know what it is because we're terrible people. And Polly told you last night what a terrible person she was. And you could all see what a terrible person she is, right? But that's what we're told. See, governments conquer with military might, but they govern with stories. Because they understand that stories are woven into the human system. And we all labor under a story about what Genesis 3 and Matthew 1 really mean. What if that story's wrong? What if we've lived out a story and tried to live out our church life and live out our Christian life and live out all the things that we've been told about Jesus and what he came to give us, and we live it out because we've misdefined the problem that Jesus came to solve? But if we read Genesis 3 with Genesis 4 eyes, and if we read Genesis 1 and 2 with Genesis 4 minds, we absolutely will define it wrongly. And that, I think, is where we start. If we can go back and straighten up the tree at the place where it first went crooked, maybe we can really begin to realize things you didn't even know were possible are easily handed back to you by a Jesus who came to solve a problem that you misunderstood, that I misunderstood. Here's what happens. Genesis 3, there's a fundamental shift. Because not only did Adam and Eve commit a misbehavior, a crime, a sin, whatever you want to call it, but something happened in that chapter, something happened in that moment where they changed from this tree to this tree that changed their fundamental nature. And yet their drive for freedom didn't go away. Their strategy for getting it changed. And part of that is what changed fundamentally is a way of thinking. A way of knowing. And that way of knowing is kind of like these things for me, right? By the way, you guys, without these, you guys look amazing. I'm not gonna tell you what happens when I put them on, but you look amazing. Yeah, of course. You guys look like a Monet painting to me. If you don't know Monet, he's an impressionist and everything's a little bit fuzzy all the time. It's not really flowers, it's just the impression of a flower. I get the impression of people. Then I put these on and you become people. Huh, you have teeth. and actual hair, not just a lovely kind of glow around the top of your head. See, but what happens is, from time to time, though it happens less often than it once did, I'll set these down somewhere around the house, and it comes time to get ready to leave the house. Where'd you guys go? It comes time to leave the house, and I'll go, hey, babe, do you know where I put my glasses? See, when I lose my glasses, I don't just have one problem, I have two problems, right? The first problem is I've lost something, super deep, right? I've lost something. But the second problem is the thing that I've lost is the way that I find lost things. Genesis 3 is the moment where we lost the way that we find our way back. And we can search, but our eyes are blinded and our mind has been changed and our way of knowing, our way of seeing has been so fundamentally shifted that our search for the way back is completely around our misdefinition of what happened to poor old Adam and Eve in those moments. And so we're searching for our way back to this tree using the fruit of this tree. And you cannot get there. It is impossible to find the tree of life through the branches of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That is the problem with the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So we labor under the story. What we've been governed by the story that sounds like this. Funny thing is, I'm about to tell you something that's wrong, and some of you will think, no, that's not wrong. It'll sound so right, you'll go, what's wrong with that? And even having gone through the labor of telling you how wrong it is and how you're gonna think that way, it'll feel right to your cells. So here it goes. Let the wrestling begin. This is the story we've been governed by. God made a rule. There's the first problem, right? God's not much of a rule maker. He kind of tells you how reality works and then says, have at it. You can either work with it or work against it. He leaves a ton of freedom to the human race. Like I said last night, three-year-old garbage dump, not really freedom. It's danger if you have no constraint, right? But he leaves a ton of no constraint because he's kind of got a plan. And he wants us to learn that plan. He's wanting us to engage. So we think God made a rule. Adam and Eve broke the rule. There's this legal judgment over them that we all have suffered from this legal judgment over them. Jesus came to right the legal judgment. And if you'll receive Jesus, you can just kind of receive his forgiveness, but hang on and do the best you can to do the best you can between now and when he gets back. And that's the story that's governed us. Whether you use that language or not, most of us wouldn't use that language because it sounds a little bit cynical when I say it that way, but we wouldn't use that kind of language. But some version of that story is what we've been told and therefore what we've been governed by. And so we're all thinking rule breakers. And if I didn't break rules, then somewhere I'm breaking rules and I don't know about it. You've heard that one, right? Somewhere you're breaking rules that you don't know about, as if the Holy Spirit's not capable of letting you know. It's like his primary assignment, right? To let you know, hey, psst, of course, psst, of course. He'll let you know. But that myth that we've been told is a Genesis 4 thought about the events of Genesis 3. So think about this for a second. The way that you know something always matters more than what you know. Yet part of our educational process, part of our learning process, part of our discipleship process is about learning things instead of learning ways. There are things that we know, and there are ways that we know. And the ways that we know have dominion over the things that we know. Our thought processes always have dominion over our thoughts. The simple way to think about that is an optimist can hear, like, your car burned to the ground last night, and you go, cool, I wonder what insurance is going to do. Whereas a pessimist can win the lottery, and he's like, oh, the taxes are going to kill me, right? He's got a way of thinking. They both have a way of thinking. Doesn't matter the content. What matters is what's going on inside their mind. And like we talked about last night, prisoner thinking is a thought process. You can tell truth to somebody with prisoner thinking, and they think it's a rule, and they've got to get on a tightrope and make sure they follow it. You've told them freeing truth, and they're like, okay, I'll see if I can do that. I'll try really hard to get free. But one of the fundamental things we've got to understand, the way we know something always trumps what we know, even when what we know is the very scriptures themselves. So here's the words of Jesus to the Pharisees. He says, hey, you guys read the scriptures as if in them you're going to find life. But it's these that point to me. And I stand in front of you and you won't even acknowledge who I am. He's not saying don't read the scriptures. He's saying don't read them in a way that they become your God themselves. And later he says, as if that wasn't enough, it's like Jesus is never subtle, right? Except with learners. Then they're like, what are you saying? But with Pharisees, he's never subtle. He says, hey, you guys travel all the way around the world to make a single disciple. And when you make one of those disciples, they become twice the sons of hell that you are. The disciples are all stepping back going, Jesus, you're ticking them off. He's like, oh, am I? And it's all about the way of knowing, not about what they know. Jesus wasn't speaking against the scriptures. He was talking about a way of knowing the scriptures that puts the burden of self-generation, of self-maintenance, of self-protection, of self-sourcing, the burden of self-sourcing that comes out of the scriptures is the Pharisee's mindset that says, here's the book that tells you how you're supposed to accomplish something that, by the way, only God can accomplish. There's also a way of knowing that you can talk to somebody over a freshly picked stalk of wheat, a meal over speaking with somebody who's stolen from his own countrymen, a freshly caught boat full of fish, and in a simple conversation, you can give rivers of life to somebody. Not because of the content of the conversation, but because of the way of knowing what we're talking about. See, there's a reason why Jesus said, I am the way. He didn't say, I'm the what? He said, I'm the way. And there's a way of knowing things. There's a way of knowing the scriptures, a way of knowing human beings. There's a way of knowing truth. There's a way of knowing information. There's a way of knowing car wrecks and winning the lottery that gives life to people. And there is a way of knowing all of those things that brings death. And the way that brings death began with a simple act in Genesis chapter 3 that we call the original sin. But here's the irony. We all think the problem Jesus came to solve was the problem of sin. I always feel like when I'm up against heresy or the perception of heresy. But the dilemma is the word sin doesn't occur in Genesis 3 anywhere. It doesn't. There's a story. There's a narrative, there's a description of an event that's very significant, and a description of an event that shifted the nature of the human soul, but the word sin doesn't occur until Genesis 6. We don't really see the word sin until three whole chapters later. And yet we think Jesus came to solve the problem of sin. But it may seem that the Bible doesn't indicate that, at least the way that we've thought about sin. Now, if that scares you, hold, don't shift. I promise to come around and address that in roughly 17 minutes, maybe 14, I'm not sure, but somewhere around there, I promise to come back and address that. But I want you to understand, even the way that we think about sin is often a Genesis 4 thought about a single word instead of a Genesis 2 understanding of how to understand that word. And if we have a Genesis 4 thought about the word sin, and I just told you Jesus didn't come to solve that problem, you're going to feel scared about it. Joel, are you going to let him say that? Quick, get him off your stage. This is my third time here, by the way. So far, he hasn't pulled me off the stage. So here's, to really get the shift, to really get the power, the significance of this shift, I think it's important to examine Genesis 2 in a brand new way. Because if we understand Romans 5 correctly, Jesus gave back what Adam gave away. Right? Jesus didn't just give you something you've never had before. He came and said, by the way, your forefather's forefather's forefather, Adam, had something, and he lost it. And when he lost it, we set in motion a plan. Actually, the plan was set in motion even before Adam was created. But we set in motion a plan to come back, give you back what is your birthright. What you were created for. What did I tell you last night? Freedom, right? There's a plan to give that back to you. But to really get the shift, I want us to think about Genesis 2 in a particular way, a couple of particular ways. These days, I have to like take these off to read and put them back on to see you, and it's just easier than sticking plastic in my eyes. Genesis chapter 2, verse 9 tells us something. It says, out of the ground, the Lord God caused to grow every tree that's pleasing to the sight and good for food. The tree of life also in the midst of the garden and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, that's all the only verse I'm going to read out of there. But if you read this, the entire section there of Genesis 2 is really doing something that an author or a writer would say, setting the scene. Like for every story that we're told and every story that runs our being, there's also a context, there's a background, there's a scene in which the story takes place. And in many cases, the scene is itself a part of the story. And that's why setting the scene is so crucial to a writer or even a communicator of any kind. And in this section, we see something in setting the scene. We see something in setting the scene about how to see things in the scene. Yeah, that's right. We see things about setting the scene. I'll stop. I'm amusing myself at this point. Here's what we begin to see, right? There's a description that God put in the garden some trees. And among them, he describes two very specific trees. The tree of life, over here. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, over here. And he says, no, these two trees basically tell us something about the nature of reality through Adam and Eve's eyes. Now, let me just get a show of hands. How many of you guys have ever seen trees before? Now, I've asked this question in Lubbock, a bunch of them look confused. They're like, what, trees? What, trees? We got brush, we got bushes. And if you're from Lubbock, I'm joking, of course. I'm from Michigan, where the trees are like 150 feet tall. But, you know, we've all seen trees, but let me ask you this. How many of you have ever seen life before? How many of you have ever seen knowledge? Right, see, we don't perceive those things the same way we perceive trees. Trees are, they reflect light. The light comes to our eyes and our eyes do all that stuff to our neurological system. We get a representation of the trees inside of our mind and we see them. Knowledge and life as defined by those trees is actually a spiritual fruit growing from a natural bush or a natural tree. There's something that's invisible to you and I. It wasn't to Adam and Eve. But there's something that's invisible to you and I that's growing from a visible plant. And so part of the nature of two things, the nature of the garden and the nature of Adam and Eve in this moment, is that Adam and Eve could perceive both the natural and the what we would call supernatural attributes of the garden. The nature of the garden is that the garden was a place where both the heavens and the earth grew in an integrated way. And as a result, you've got physical trees with spiritual fruit growing off the branches. And you've got a being in the garden who can so perceive both halves of reality. He can walk up to that tree and pick the spiritual fruit, hold it in his hand, take it to his mouth, take a bite, chew, swallow, and then let it go through his digestive system. So to Adam and Eve, there wasn't such a thing as supernatural. There was natural, and within the natural, there was spiritual. They were one and the same, but experienced somewhat differently. But the other thing we can know about that is that Adam could see it. If we, in the state that we're in right now, went back to the garden, it might look like winter. All the trees would look barren because we would only see trees, but we wouldn't see the fruit hanging from the branches. And Adam and Eve in their original state would go, you don't see the fruit, we'd go, we would call them conspiracy theorists. Sorry, did I say that out loud? Thanks. Pull it back. But it's because they had a way of seeing, and their way of seeing came from their way of being, and their way of being came from their created design. So now we go back a little bit further and we realize that when God picked up the ball of dirt and formed it into the image of man, He's in the act of creation. And what he does is he takes this non-living thing called a ball of dirt and he breathes something called the breath of life into the nostrils of the man. And for a moment, this something becomes a someone, all because of not what he's wearing, what he's doing, what his profession is, what kind of car he drives, how his hair looks on the given day, but rather he becomes a someone because of the breath inside of him. So the something becomes a someone. And imagine for a moment, the first act of worship was to exhale. Breath in, breath out. Now keep in mind, Adam didn't go, quick, someone give me the Old Testament so I don't screw this thing up. He just went, I'm alive. Life to him, life in him, life through him. And Adam, the only person, the only being on earth in that moment and ever really created in that fashion, was created in that fashion to fulfill the purpose of God, that we, the human race, would be the beings that have one hand in the heavens, connected to God, one hand on the earth, feet on the ground itself, and that we become the bridge that holds those two realms together. And as God runs the kingdom of God, we run the kingdom of the earth. And as long as we stay integrated and connected to him, the earth reflects the heavens perfectly. And it worked awesomely for about half a chapter. That's a big book to only have that work for half a chapter. But half a chapter in, God goes, oh, by the way, he's headed out to five guys. And he says, by the way, well, I'm gone. Don't eat from the fruit of that tree. Like I said earlier. Now remember, Adam and Eve are the kind of people that can look at those trees and see fruit. They're the kind of people that take in everything, and not only their way of seeing, but their way of knowing and way of understanding is informed by this receive, contain, broadcast way of living. See, when we talk about a way of living as believers, we often think, yes, we should behave better. That's a thought, not a thought process. But the thought process in the garden was God to me, God in me, God through me, and it was a natural flow that was just part of how we all lived our lives. They didn't stop and think, what would God have me do? They inhaled and God did it through them. And when they exhaled, God was doing what he wanted to do when he came into them. There was no consideration of what are the rules? What are the Ten Commandments? Wait, what did God say in, you know, whichever chapter you want to cite? It was simply, and through that, God made the earth a perfect replica of the heavens. And he said to man, take dominion over the creation. What that doesn't mean is we set up a governmental program and we march around with our AR-15s and we tell everybody to do the things God told them to do. What that means is that the nature of God entered the areas that we lived in through our exhale. So dominion isn't about governmental control, it's about love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, meekness, mercy, and self-control coming to me, living in me, and moving through me. And in doing that, the person of God himself enters the space that I inhabit, and you too. And that's the plan. Except for this darn tree. This darn tree over here, the one that God said not to eat and immediately got Adam and Eve's attention, this tree changed everything. And I want to tell you something before we get to the tree. There is also a picture of the Genesis 4 mind that Adam and Eve were perfect before they ate from the fruit of the tree. And logic alone would have to tell you that there's no way they could have been perfect before they ate from the fruit of the tree because they made the decision to do it before they ate it. See, Adam and Eve weren't perfect. They were just perfectly connected. They weren't perfect in nature. They were perfect in receptivity. They were perfect in dependence. And because of that, what came to them was if there was any flaw, any weakness, anything that wasn't God-like in them, God himself was God-like in them. And as long as they stayed in that completely dependent, completely cyclical, God to us, me back to God, God to us, me back to God, that's why when we worship, with song, and we're not trying to memorize things and think things and become logical about things. We're receiving from God kind of that adoration, but we're returning it right to him. And we're as close to kind of that process, receive, contain, broadcast, when we're worshiping in song, more so than when you make the shift and get out your notebooks. Oh, now I'm just learning stuff. But for Adam, there was a something about his nature that came from the way that he was both created and the way that he maintained that creation. Because God breathed the breath of life into his nostrils, but God didn't stop breathing at that moment. And Adam's like, and you've got kind of the cyclical thing where life to him, life in him, life back to the creator, and life to the creation. And it was just kind of this thing where life came to the world from God to man, through man to the creation. Such a great plan. It seems odd, doesn't it, that God would even put this tree in the garden? But there's something crucial about man learning the proper use of his will that God would, I think, that God would allow this moment in history to show up. So he puts the tree there. He tells Adam and Eve, hey, don't, remember he didn't say, you dare not eat. He said, don't eat from the fruit of the tree, because if you do, you're going to die. Then he goes off to, you know, Five Guys to have a double with cheese and grilled mushrooms. And sorry, did I tell you we're doing a cleanse? So God is, you know, whatever he's doing in these moments, Adam and Eve take a look at this tree. And they're like, is this the one that he said? Is this the one? What? It fell right off in my hands. It doesn't look dangerous. In fact, it kind of looks like if I ate that, my eyes would be opened and I would become wise. Remember what we said last night? Satan's kind of constant assignment is he says, I'm going to tell you to work hard to get something that's already yours. So Satan comes along and he says, you know, if you eat that, you'll be like God. And as I said last night, at that point in history, there was nobody more like God than Adam and Eve. They were in his nature and they contained his nature, and they were as like him as a human can ever be. And Satan says, do this thing and you will be like God. And they're like, I have to do a thing to be like God? Okay. I don't think Adam and Eve were poorly motivated, though they should have known. I mean, God did tell them, if you eat from this, you'll surely die. So they take it, they eat from the fruit of the tree, and in that moment, listen, God did say, don't do this. And there is a consequence, there's a result for this. But the issue isn't so much that they broke a rule and there's a legal ruling hanging over them. There's an actual change in our nature that happened. And that actual change is, if what was happening before is God to us, God in us, and God through us, we shut the door on that, and we turned to another, oh, this tree of the knowledge of good and evil over here, right? We shut the door on the tree of life, sorry. Got you eating from the wrong tree already. See what happens? We shut the door on the tree of life and we go back over here to this one called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And where we get our source from here, we stop doing that and we turn to this one over here. And our new source is something called knowledge. Both the knowledge of good and the knowledge of evil. And so they go from kind of this constant circular flow where God is their source to in just a split second moment, they become their own source. And the way they become their own source is, huh, I think I know what's right and I think I know what's wrong. And if I'll choose the right thing and try to overcome the wrong thing, then God will be happy with me and I'll get my way back to him. And so what we think is that Christianity and discipleship is about getting people out of the branch called the knowledge of evil and into the branch called the knowledge of good. That's what the Pharisees spent all their energy on. This branch is evil. Do not do these things. Do the things we do because this is the branch called the knowledge of good. I call them the keepers of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But they're not the only ones. We have modern day keepers of that tree. And we use this book to defend it. And we tell people, stop the bad, start the good, and you will please God. And that's knowing our way back to God, which is impossible. See, the trunk of this tree is knowledge, and the roots of it is self. My knowledge will never get me back to his life. No matter how much, no matter how right, no matter what source of information I have, no amount of knowledge, no correctness of knowledge, no captively presented knowledge will ever get us back from this tree and back to this tree, because knowledge itself is the problem. Listen, I'm not an advocate of becoming stupid. That's not what I'm talking about. I think as long as knowledge is submitted to life, knowledge is a powerful tool. But when knowledge dictates life, we're all dying. So imagine for a second, I may scare some of the younger people in the room, but there was a moment in history when the internet came from the wall. I know, it may seem odd, but in my house there was a big fat blue cable at the end of which was something that looked like a phone jack, only bigger, and it plugged into the back of my computer where all the data went in, and then I had another cable where power went in, and it plugged into the outlet on the wall. So this giant computer, you guys remember, right? Huge computer, plugged into two places. One of them brought in data, one of them brought in power. Now imagine for a second if you unplugged the power cable and plugged the data cable in where the power cable went. What would happen? The computer would surely die. And this is exactly what happened in Genesis 3. In Genesis 3, we unplugged from the power cable and we took away the source of all life. And in that moment, we begin to lose power. But our theory is if we plug into the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and I get my verses right and I memorize as much as I can and I quote them when I'm trying to overcome stuff and I'm using all the information I can, somehow data will become power. But the problem isn't that the data is incorrect or the data is wrong or the data is bad. The problem is that data isn't power. And knowledge isn't life. Whether it's good knowledge, bad knowledge, average knowledge, meh knowledge, knowledge isn't life. So we find ourselves in this position where as soon as Adam and Eve consumed the fruit of that tree, they move from this beautiful, receive, contain, broadcast, natural flow, where the life of God indwelt them as a natural, easy, ongoing way of living. They move to connect to this tree over here, and all of a sudden they shift to this very difficult process that I call consider, decide, initiate. Let me think about it. Yeah, I think I'll do that. Now I use my own initiative to go do the thing that I've carefully considered and decided what I think is the right pros and cons, ask some good counsel. I've got all the data that I need. I'm going to proceed and I will initiate this. And the problem is we were born into a system that operates from consider, decide, initiate. Let me tell you part of the problem with consider, decide, initiate, besides the fact that that tree will kill you, right? Part of the problem is I taught one of my children who will remain unnamed if I carefully don't identify gender, taught all of them how to drive. And there's a moment where I'm in a particular parking lot with one of them, and he's in the driver's seat, so he's got all the power. That's a problem right there, right? Right. And he's in this parking lot, he's headed towards kind of an entrance with three dumpsters right by the entrance. So you can't actually see if cars are coming in or out. So as he's headed toward this entrance, picking up speed, I said, hey, stop. And he turns and looks at me as he blows right through it and says, why? Part of the problem with consider, decide, initiate is it's still us with our hands on the steering wheel and our hands on the gas. And consider, decide, initiate would make Jesus as Lord being, he tells us the rules and we decide whether or not we're going to follow them. What a horrible way to live that would be, and what a miserable evangelistic tool that would be. Try to invite people into that, the obsessive compulsive will come running. Sorry if you're one of them. Man, if you've got a system by which the adherence to rules is the key to the kingdom of heaven, then you can get a certain amount of people coming. And by the way, it's super marketable. But if the system's not even at all about that, and the knowledge of good and evil, which everyone can see, here's the good stuff, here's the bad stuff, don't drink, do read your Bible, don't smoke, do pray. That stuff is so easy. But you know what's hard? God, what are you doing right now? And in that moment to sit and sense and discern and learn to recognize the living and active voice of God, that takes some presence. That takes some engagement. Here's a scary one to people. That takes some independence from the people that you want to tell you what to do. That takes you relating directly to God instead of sending Moses or Joel up the mountain to get a word for you. And one of the reasons that the knowledge of good and evil is so marketable is people can present themselves as the ones who have the right knowledge and can tell you the wrong things. And those people who do it well become very popular. Because we all think that's the way to live. But see, God would say, no, you hear me, and you hear me, and you hear me, and you hear me, and you hear me. You all hear me for yourself. I want a relationship with you, not you to have a relationship through someone else with me. That's, I don't know if you have thought about this, but that's not easy. And to teach people that, like as parents, you guys know as parents, our job is to help our kids become independent, not more dependent. Which means we're supposed to be teaching them not to need us. And in teaching them not to need us, we're teaching them, part of the process is letting them mess some stuff up. Don't eat from the fruit of that tree. Remember what I said earlier, the importance of the human will is each of us has to learn that the importance of your will isn't to choose between two branches on a tree. What bad thing must I avoid? What good thing must I engage? But rather to learn, I'm going to give you this beautiful word that everybody cringes at first, but it's one of those kind of, you know, getting free from bad definitions, but instead to learn submission. Not what you think, not subjection, not God, tell me what to do and I will follow you. Listen, as right as that sounds, he wants to do it through you instead of you get the information and make a decision about it. And so the use of the human will when we go to submission isn't about making a decision, it's about surrender. It's about going back to this place of, I've spent my life initiating. If I'm gonna become a good guitar player, I'm gonna work hard at playing my chords. That makes sense. If I'm gonna become a good athlete, I'm gonna work hard at my sport. That makes sense. But to become a good believer, we have to undo that thinking and understand that your initiative is an obstacle to his move through you. Now your surrender, oh, he loves that. In those moments where you can just kind of release and stop striving so hard, where you can give up your intelligence and your strategies and all those things and just go, God, I'm in need. I'm empty. I might have had meat, but my bones still feel hungry. And when you can stand in front of him in need, he goes, this is how you get back to the tree of life. Because the tree of life was never about your sufficiency, our sufficiency. The tree of life was about his sufficiency in and through us. And yet, like Jesus said to the crowd, hey, I didn't come for the healthy. I came for the sick. And so if you're okay without me, I'm not gonna impose myself on you. But if you can come and say, hey, I think I'm done with me. You don't have to beat yourself up. You don't have to shame yourself on your face on the ground. You don't have to talk about the shame that Polly talked about yesterday and so much the human race deals with. That kind of shame isn't necessary to receive from God. Just the acknowledgement that I am in need. So the Genesis 4 mind says, but aren't we supposed to glorify God with our lives? To which I would say, absolutely. But what does that actually mean? What's a Genesis 2 concept of glorifying God? Well, here's how I like to think about that. This, welcome to my mind. But let me just ask this question. How do you glorify a dentist? And a lot of people go, well, good oral hygiene. I brush my teeth, I floss, I, you know, good oral hygiene. I say, no, that actually glorifies you. You can go to the dentist and tell them how good you are, you know, at keeping up your teeth. You want to glorify a dentist, show up with cavities and open your mouth and go, ah. How do you glorify a redeeming, restoring, healing, to become one, God? You show up with your weakness. You show up with the real version of you. You show up with where you are, not where you think you ought to be. You show up with the life that you do have, not the knowledge of good you think you should have. And you show up with that vacancy and that need, and you stand in front of them and you go, ah, ah. The return from consider, decide, initiate to the life of receive, contain, broadcast may be one of the most difficult assignments for us. And what I say all the time is some of the most difficult people to help find freedom are high performers on earth. CEOs, athletes, people that are really great at earth, sometimes not so great at spiritual stuff because, like I said, the stuff that makes me a better athlete, better musician, sometimes even a better CEO, though I would argue that. The things that make me good at the performance of earth things can easily work against me at spiritual things. When my consider, decide, initiate has succeeded, that's almost more dangerous than when it fails. Because when it succeeds, I think God is blessing me. There's this incredible moment in Romans 5 where Paul's been arguing this whole idea that, you know, what Jesus gave back was what Adam lost, and he goes on to talk about this idea and on into Romans 6 where he says, you know, that the problem is, you know, when you come to him with sin, the more sin you bring to him, the more his grace abounds. Now, of course, Paul understands the human mind. He immediately says, now, that doesn't mean you sin more so that grace abounds. None of you thought that. Eat more Oreos? Sweet. What it means is your deepest need is like the deep part of the sidewalk where the water comes, and when the water comes, more water shows up where the deep part is. And the deepest needs of your heart are the places where God says, this is where I'm most at home in the human soul. Not because he loves pain, not because he loves your suffering, but because he loves when we come to the place of, I've run out of me. And in running out of me, I open my mouth and I go, ah. And the tree of life, which has been just over our shoulder waiting, breathes into us again the breath of life. And in breathing into us the breath of life, we go, and the danger would be that we go, oh, we've now come up with a strategy. Let's now start presenting our needs. Dear God, we are here in great need. And we have a knowledge of good called presenting our needs instead of a fundamental awareness. See, the dilemma with this is that every behavior can come from either tree. Every behavior we do in life and every behavior we do in church can come from either tree. And sometimes we reward the wrong tree way too often. There's a moment in scripture where God looks, Ezekiel 10, where God looks down and he says, hey, you guys have gotten pretty good at this church thing. I think I'm taking off. He leaves the Holy of Holies and goes and sits up on the wall of the temple and he looks down to see what the priests do when God's not there. You know what they do? They just keep doing what they were doing when he was there. They just keep doing what they were doing. It's almost like they didn't notice his departure. Because when you're operating out of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, your strategy is sufficient and your dependence wanes. And he leaves and you don't notice. And there's the dilemma. Something's fresh today. And so you keep doing it because it worked yesterday and you worked the day before and it worked the day before. And on day 10, God goes, hey, that's not what I'm doing today. And you go, but it worked. And so you do it for the next 3 years and wonder why you're dry. But it's a lot like manna, right? Manna. It's here today, but don't pick enough for tomorrow. If you pick some for tomorrow, tomorrow it's going to be rotten anyway. It's just for today. So the thing that we do, people always say, so what do I do? The thing that we do is we tell people the activity of hearing God's voice and learning to discern, recognize, and respond to his voice is the key activity of the kingdom and the key activity of receive, contain, broadcast. And if you hear that and go, oh no, I can't do that, you are built for it. Everything about the nature of your soul was constructed with receive, contain, broadcast in mind. It's the knowledge of good and evil that makes you think you can't do it. It makes you think you're not good at hearing. Let me just, real quickly, who's not hearing my voice today? Anyone? Anyone in the room who's not hearing my voice? Okay, good. You guys are awesome at hearing. Every single one of you has succeeded at hearing for the last 40 minutes. So that means you're built for hearing, and you're built for hearing God because there's place inside where his breath was designed to live. I'm talking with a gentleman the other day on Zoom, one of my sessions. He strived his whole life and he succeeded his work but didn't succeed in his marriage, and things are just really tense for him all the time. His body's racked with pain. And we're praying. The Lord shows him a place and a time where he made a decision that no one else would ever take care of him, so he had to take care of himself. And we began to pray and say, God, what would you say to this man about that moment in time that this happened? And he looks at me and goes, I'm not hearing anything. I said, but what is happening? He said, well, my body feels more at peace than it's felt my entire life. Inside me, I don't feel like I'm on fire. Inside me, I feel an overwhelming sense of peace in my body. I said, then consider that God has spoken the word peace to you. See, we want it to come with angels and an accompanying Christmas carol. And so we think we haven't heard the voice of God, but just pay attention to what happens when you ask a question and listen. Pay attention to what happens when you're at least willing to hear from him, and consider that maybe what comes next, if it produces peace and it produces freedom, produces the fruits of the Spirit and lines up with the scripture, consider that that may actually be him. And the number one activity, I think, of all spiritual leaders is to help their followers learn to hear the voice of God and learn to discern it as they do, because that returns us and restores us again to the place of receive, contain, broadcast. Let me tell you a story. I taught this idea, the two trees, Genesis 3, Genesis 4, mind. I taught this to a group of believers overseas once. And these are fervent believers and have committed their whole lives. A couple of them in the room have been tortured and put in jail for believing in Jesus. And I kind of went into it thinking, man, I don't have that kind of faith. And as we spent our time going through the week together, it began to become evident to me that one of the reasons they were willing to be tortured and put in jail for their faith is they were raised in a dictatorship. And so their internal model of the Lord, of lordship, was dictatorship. Man, that'll just pound the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in deep. Your knowledge of good will become intense when you live under a dictator who you call God. But because their internal model was dictatorship, they just changed from their dictator politician to their dictator up in heaven. And so they will go to jail and be tortured. I'm not at all denigrating their faith. These were earnest believers. What I'm saying is their picture of God was something completely different. And we spent a lot of that week trying to help them understand God was a father, not a dictator. But somewhere in that, we taught this lesson about the two trees and helped these people who had so committed to climb as high as they could in the knowledge, the branch called the knowledge of good. They'd gotten really good at it. That sounds like such a good thing, and it looks so admirable. No judgment in my heart. We've all been taught that. We all come into a system that operates that way. But to them, it had all been about showing up with their sufficiency and giving all of what they had to God instead of showing up with their emptiness and receiving all that he had for them. And they came to me at breakfast the next morning. Breakfast is a very holy thing. And they said, look, Bob, our leaders stayed up all night last night talking about what you taught them. And they said, we think you're right, but we don't know what to do. And therein lies the dilemma. Knowing what to do is this tree over here. Not knowing what to do feels like weakness, right? And so as we quickly punted and we changed the morning session And I got up the first morning after having taught them that at night. And I said, let me tell you something and then show you something. I talked about the parable that Jesus tells about the tax collector and the Pharisee. Remember the parable? He says there was a tax collector and a Pharisee who both went up in the morning to pray. And as they pray, the Pharisee looks over at the tax collector and says, "Dear God, thank you, I'm not like him." And on, right? And what I told them is, here's the dilemma. Both of them had asked the question, what should we do? And the answer that they got was, well, you should pray. So they got up early the next morning, they went to pray. You should too. You should pray. Write that down. But the problem wasn't what they were doing. The problem was the way, because the way is always more important than the what. One went up to pray and he said, "Dear God, thank you that I'm not like him. Thank you that I have done everything right my entire life, and that because of that, I am blessed in thy sight, and therefore I shall use King James in my conversation." The tax collector could barely stand, and he said, "God, I have nothing to bring you. I've ruined people's lives, and I've ruined my lives. I just stand in front of you to say I have nothing to give you." And Jesus asked the question, which one of these guys is justified in God's sight, right? Which one of these men is God speaking to, and which one is just speaking to himself, thinking it's about God? The question's the answer is evident. It's the answer to the "what should I do then" question isn't the what to do. And that's a problem with this tree, is it tells you that the answer is, what should I do then? And this tree says it's not the what, it's the way. So I said, let me show you what I'm talking about. There's a they had a worship team and several young ladies, and one of the women on the worship team, I don't know how else to describe this, but when she would sing, it was just a little juicier, just a little more kind of a lift in the spirit in the room. We would use the term anointing maybe, right? There's something that she had that when she opened her mouth to sing, something more moved in the room. And so I had set this up ahead of time. I invited her up to stand between me and her leader so he could translate. She didn't speak English at all. And I just did a quick interview with her. I said, "Are you good at singing?" The worship team is cringing, right? Because the question, "Are you good at singing?" is an intent on my part to get her to turn to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil to find an answer. My friends were like, "You're kind of a jerk, Bob." She goes, I guess. I mean, how do you answer that when you're put on the spot in front of all your friends and humility is a value, right? She says, "I guess." I said, "How'd you get good at singing? Did you practice? Did you get training? Did you?" She's like, I just practice. She felt so, you know, it's what happens when someone who's filled with life gets thrust into the knowledge of good and evil. You feel like humbled. People who celebrate the tree of the knowledge of good and evil climb it eagerly. "Oh yes, I'm a good singer because..." I said, "So, you know, what I'd love for you to do is I'd like for you to pick your favorite worship song and just sing it to these 300 people in the room." So she takes the microphone and she sings, I'm not as brave as Polly, I may not sing, but, "For thou, O Lord, art high above all the earth," right? And she starts to sing that. And then the second part of that is, "I exalt thee." And she's singing that, and I'm telling you, it was like God was on it. God wasn't not there. But when she finished, I said, "Would you do me a favor then? What I want you to do is just get still and kind of tune into God and now ask him to sing his favorite song to you." And she stood, and I watched her lips start to tremble. And I said, "Ask him what he calls you, what his name is for you." And I watched tears start to come down her eyes. And I said, just let him, allow him to sing his favorite song to you. Now she's shaking, just shaking. The room's getting thick. And so for a few moments, I let her just hear. And I said, "When you can, sing back to him what he's singing to you." She shook for at least a minute, which is forever in a setting like that. And then out of pitch, trembling voice, she began to sing the exact same song. But the room filled with thunder. Literally, both the translator and I couldn't help but go to our knees. In the front row, same exact time, went to their knees. And God just began to kind of fold back over the room as she was off key and voice weak with trembling. But what was happening is she was back to receive, contain, broadcast. And now what came out of her wasn't just music. It was power. It was presence. It was the breath of life to her, in her, and ultimately, finally, through her. And as powerful as God's presence was the first time through, because she'd learned the posture of receive, to intentionally turn her attention to, in those moments, fully receive and not let it out until she had permission to do so, everything changed. The most important thing that I will say to you this weekend is that there are two trees in the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil holds all of our minds until it doesn't. And the way we get back isn't by climbing higher, it's by climbing lower and walking across the ground and saying, no matter what I've learned, no matter how much I've succeeded or failed, no matter how much pain I've had or joy I've had, I come to you with my need, not my strength. Let's take a moment to get still and pray. See, that's not just a story about a young lady in China. That's a story about you and I. And it's not just a story about music. It's a story about breath. It's a story about a way. And that way has never been about you finding the best strategy you can and working hard at it. That way has always been about finding the honesty with yourself to show up real and in need and to tune in and learn to hear his voice, and in hearing his voice, letting his breath come to you and in you. Just in the stillness of where you are right now, I want you to bring to him whatever place of weakness, whatever place of need. Even if what you want to bring to him is successes that you had counted as, Lord, look what I did, and instead show up and say, look, through me, through you, all things are possible in me. But in this moment, show up weak. Show up tired. I don't think that's hard. I mean, it is. It's hard to admit. But if you've been in this thing for any length of time, tired is often the answer to how are you doing. Bring tired to him and say, some part of me has been working really hard at this. And I just want to show up ready to receive. And Father, as we turn our attention toward your willingness to fill, would you help each of us find that place that you most want to fill this morning? And bring it to you uncovered, unhidden. God, in these moments, would you breathe again the breath of life? Into that place where some have been empty for years. Others showed up this morning looking for more, and everywhere in between. Would you just breathe again the breath of life?